roomed, mudder, floored, bothy cum bunkhouse affairs, where they were probably forced to forage to survive. In fact, the multi-roomed house contained several bathrooms and bedrooms, a large kitchen, an expertly tended garden, and no fewer than 3 boxes of luxury Scottish shortbread awaiting our arrival. Dad's friend Dave had arrived ahead of us and was already in the process of unloading enough rations to last us for several weeks more than required. Dad, misinterpreting my wide-eyed astonishment as one of concern, sought to comfort me. "Don't worry, Will. We will have food in the pub on at least one of the nights, and Nigel will soon be here with his wife's homemade lasagna." I wondered, seriously, whether I would still fit in my waders at the end of my time in Scotland. Dave was far and away the most experienced salmon angler I had ever met. He organised the trips to Scotland and had a wealth of knowledge. As such, I hung on his words, and his words weren't that great. "They took 77 fish last April, a new Findhorn record," he began positively.
"So where were they when we were here in March?" chirped in Dad with a chuckle.
"Still all at sea," answered Dave solemnly. "But the conditions are even worse for us now. We're going to have to work really hard for our fish." I couldn't quite believe it. Having begun this adventure with it absolutely shelling it down and facing up to flooded rivers, it was now too dry. "They just can't move. The salmon are either waiting to enter the river or they're stuck in the pools and going into a dormant state." Dave glanced outside at the crisp weather and clear skies with more than just a furrow in his brow. "We need 2 foot of water from somewhere. Praying for rain in Scotland, I'd seen it all." At daybreak, I shuffled my feet through leaves that crunched as if they had been baked in salt overnight. It hadn't rained, but I did have a raging headache. Nigel had arrived after dark, barreling through the doors with irrepressible energy, his wife's lasagna and a fantastically rural Lincolnshire accent on hand. As is typical on virtually any holiday exclusively for adults, we got overexcited at the prospect of the coming days, overdid it on the wine, and then decided an impromptu blind tasting of all the single malt we had brought with us was a brilliant idea. I had comfortably lost the game to my more experienced company and was now feeling decidedly rough. Luckily, though, the Findhorn was poised to provide perfect distraction. In front of a fishing hut that wouldn't have looked out of place in backwoods Alaska, the river swept my hangover away with all her majesty. I'm not basing this on any knowledge, of course, but the Tweed always sounded a bit twee to me. Prolific for sure, and very pretty, but its border's location made it all feel a little too accessible and easy. The Findhorn, however, purely by name alone, conjured up images of a craggy and mysterious waterway, a place frequented by trolls and witches, or you might even still find an army of Iron Age Picts casually barbecuing a deer and entirely unaware that Hadrian's Wall had been turned into a tourist attraction. In actuality, the Findhorn was all of these things and more. It cut a deep cleft into the side of a heavily forested ravine, and the size of the stones scattered on the outside of the bend acted as a testament to the sheer violence the river could wreak. The carpet of moss and lichen on practically every tree in view lent the place a magical green hue. It hummed with wildlife, and confident-looking chaffinch and robin took scraps of bread practically from our fingertips. I sipped at a fortifying cup of tea and noted a community of toads swirling in the pools below my feet. Further down, mustelid prints on virtually every exposed patch of sand signalled that there was a very healthy population of otters in residence. The river was impossible to ignore. It meandered under a compelling black tea curtain of colour in the deeper pools and broke into a forceful white in the shallows and rapid tops, clattering over the rocks with a hollow, rolling sound like a bottle of champagne might if you threw it down a flight of stairs. I shuddered at the thought of what it must look like in high water and was warned to be very careful if I headed upstream into the gorge. Downpours brought instant changes to the Findhorn's water levels, blasting the gorge with water and claiming the lives of unsuspecting wading anglers in times past. Our gillie, George, a very friendly old Scotsman who wore a traditional tweed cap and smart-looking tie, had offered to help me learn to spay cast. It was a new but necessary discipline,
The salmon rod required the use of two hands on the cork grip and was much longer and heavier than I was used to. The lines were much thicker too, and as I'd have to learn to cast some distance at times, it was best that I learn how to execute the cast correctly. The spey cast, so named after the wide Scottish river, provided the salmon angler with a far more powerful cast than what could be achieved on standard trout fishing gear. Critically, the method also kept most of your line in motion in front of you, meaning that you could cast a considerable distance, even with obstacles, such as trees and bushes, directly over your shoulders. I carefully taped up the joints of the rod Dad had lent me for the trip. Apparently, the jolting shock of the spey cast had enough beef to occasionally rip rod sections apart. I doubted I'd generate enough power to achieve that feat, but I enjoyed playing along as if I could. I had tried to spey cast once before, on the River Wye. A friend of a friend had a regular rod up there, and unable to make it one evening, it got offered out to us. I leapt at the chance, but unfortunately, I found spey casting about as subtle as fishing with a giant broom handle and ship's rope. Angling success revolves around confidence, and as I had none, we quickly gave up and went to the pub. Lift up the rod tip, roll to your right, arch the tip down, and cast in a D-shaped motion, aiming the fly for the far bank. Poor George must have said it 100 times, patiently showing me again and again how to do it, as my brow beaded with anxious sweat. "Keep that fly away," implored George. "You were looking good till you collapsed at the end, and that brings the fly closer into you." He wasn't kidding. We spent a good few minutes extracting the salmon fly from deep within the neoprene that covered my rear end. We were attempting to fish the very top of a milk bottle-shaped stretch of water. The far bank was severely undercut by the flow of the Findhorn. Red stones warped into attractive-looking coves and flat platforms. Good fish-holding areas, if only I could reach them. Eventually, I learnt to keep the fly away from my underpants, but I just couldn't get the distance no matter how hard I punched the rod out. "You need to relax and feel for a rhythm," said George. "The best casters are the lady fishers," he continued, reaching gently for my wrist. "Relax your grip." I did, and a couple of hours later my casting had improved markedly. "Let me look at that fly," George said after a time. I swung it in towards George's fingers. "Blimey, it's as bare as a baby's behind," he exclaimed. He was right. My fly was ruined from the constant whipping through the air and contact with objects other than the water. He flicked open a box of flies as colourful as a tub of Quality Street chocolates and selected a double-hooked and bright blue number. "Let's try that all again from the top of the beat." Almost immediately, a shuddering take developed into a short but firm fight. I landed a fin-perfect brown trout just shy of the bottle's neck, and consecutive casts brought me 2 more fish. Tiny salmon par this time, my first Scottish salmon, of sorts. "I think I'll celebrate with my disgusting habit," George laughed and sparked up a cigarette. Clearly spey casting wasn't supposed to be as brutal as I'd thought. And even with a stiff 13-foot rod, 15-pound leader, an enormous fly, I'd really felt the bites I'd had. Even though salmon par, fish of no more than a couple of ounces each, had given a satisfying thump. Goodness knows what a fully-fledged salmon must feel like then. "Just make sure you get through the first line of the national anthem before lifting into it," advised Nigel at lunchtime. "The absolute worst thing you can do is strike," added Dave. "Just tighten down on the fish gradually and you'll soon find it's on." The first day closed out with a single small salmon taking a swish at my fly. "They are in there. If we can just find a way to switch them on," remarked Dave as we packed up the gear. I saw one of about 5 pounds up the top. "She was beautiful," purred Nigel. "Scarpered as soon as she saw me, mind." That evening, Dad told me how Grandad had taken him to fish Ireland's Blackwater River. It was one of the best days fishing Grandad had ever had. I could tell by the way Dad began the story it was far from his best day. He took a sip of his beer and continued. "We fished at the mouth of the waste pipe, flowing from an abattoir. The anglers lined up and waited for the squeal from the pigs inside. Then the pipe would churn out enough blood to turn a whole section of the river red. Quick, son, get the net and hook out all the blood clots," he'd say. stringy, worm-like woolen lengths of clotted blood, which he'd hook and trot downstream in the hope of big bream. It was a horrific tale, and I could palpably feel Dad's sense of revulsion in the retelling. I remember catching a massive dace that day. He indicated the fish's considerable size between his palms, but his tone was one of disgust. It was horrible. Its gills poured with pig's blood. I put it straight back in. The next morning, we all stood outside in the mist as Dad diligently checked the moth traps he had set up overnight, his friends indulging him as he gleefully called out the names of each species. Red and green carpet. Hebrew character. Oh, wonderful, a nut tree tussock. It was hard to reconcile Dad's character with that of his father. Grandad was simply a product of a very different era. Dad was all peace and love, punk and revolution, tight trousers, big hair and open-minded, blue-sky thinking. Grandad, in spite of his rebellious anti-authoritarian streak, was still operating within the confines of an ultra-conservative world that had just survived one of the most severe wartime periods ever. Back then, animal welfare and ethical considerations were the indulgence of those who lived in lands of plenty and peacetime. Any small edge offered was exploited to its maximum advantage, at a time when the screws were really being twisted. You simply never knew when, or if, any edge might be offered again. Perhaps catching fish on pig's blood wasn't the end of the world. You could argue it wasn't exactly adding to the harm of the slaughterhouse simply by using its waste product. But that day at the Blackwater, the war had finished a very long time ago, and clearly, Grandad's actions were upsetting his young son. Grandad remained tough and uncompromising throughout his life. He never seemed to take a backward step over anything. I can't even recall him ever apologising. I used to admire his doggedness, his ability to laugh off almost anything, and interpreted his stubbornness as strength. To no little extent, I modelled myself on him when I was a young man. Only now it seems a little excessive, inconsiderate even. The moth collection was so much fun we lost track of ourselves and turned up quite late at the river. Grandad would never have done that, I thought. He would have fished a burning gat on the Ganges with a human head for bait if he thought it would have put him onto a monster. For Dad, though, the Findhorn was more than just the sum of its fish. Dad, we sat together on a rock promontory looking directly into a pool. This is as close to perfect as I think it's possible for a salmon run to be. We had headed further up into the gorge than I had been before, scrambling over rocks and occasionally pulling ourselves along the smooth rock slab sides by rope to get right to the very top of the beak. It was steep and tight, but there was still a prevailing quality to the air, of a sort of breathy alpine atmosphere that is only really felt in the bands of forest at the extreme ends of the globe. It didn't feel claustrophobic in there in the slightest. Pungent pine and birch forest stood tall above a maze of warped and twisted boulders, the largest of which tapered high above me as if dropped from a giant Mr. Whippy ice cream machine. In spite of the lack of water, the pools in the gorge still looked very deep and alluring. "I'm sorry, Dad." I picked myself off the stone and reached for my rod. "I can't wait any longer. I've got to have a cast." The water cascaded down in great steps of a dozen or more. At points, the entry to a pool was little more than a foot or two wide. The full force of the Findhorn's flow channeled through a natural gap you could quite easily hop across. It seemed highly improbable that any living creature could be able to swim against such power. But clearly the salmon here had found a way. Of greater concern, then, was what might happen if I hooked a fish in one of these pools and it decided to exit via such an opening. Surely it would be impossible to stay in touch with a fish if that was its will. It was a prospect that was both inviting and intimidating in equal measure. We took the pools on methodically, covering the water twice over before moving on down the staircase. I came nose to nose with a deer at one point, and we both watched a goosander chase, then swallow whole a trout. The salmon, though, continued to evade us. We headed ever deeper into the gorge, our nets and rods slung over our shoulders or held in our teeth as we were forced to rock climb with greater regularity. "It's gorilla fishing, Dad," I called out as he swung on the rope. Finally, I was about as far from the commercial fishery as it was possible to be. The sense of relief was palpable, and to no small degree, I felt I had achieved one of the major ambitions I'd set myself at the outset of this journey. Unquestionably, I'd dipped a line in some wonderful places before coming here, but the Findhorn was in a different class of magnificence. A big fish now would be very nice indeed. In the last pool of the beat, Dad makes a long cast and lets his fly drift along the edge of some rocks and out across the deeper water. It sinks into the depths and he begins a jerking retrieve, lifting the fly, which I notice looks very much like a small carrot, up through the water column and towards the surface. I'm sat high above the pool so I get a very clear view of what happens next. Just as the fly looks like it might break the surface, right at the edge of the deeper water, a salmon resembling a silver submarine emerges directly underneath the carrot, swims to within an inch of the hooks, and then drifts back into the shadows. I'm utterly stunned, but I know I can't exactly start shouting down to Dad and risk scaring the fish. I stare at his head, trying to project the scene into his brain, or at least get some sort of telepathic communication going where he might think to look up at me. It's pointless, though. He's locked within his own little world and definitely did not see the fish. He recasts and nothing happens. Maybe I imagined it. He casts again and up it floats once again. It really is huge. Comfortably the biggest salmon I've ever seen. Clearly over 15 pounds. At a push, possibly even 20 pounds. Dad! I can't help myself. Dad! I try again in my best shout whisper. I can see he's considering changing his fly. Bollocks to it. Dad! I really shout it this time. He looks straight up at me, smiling. There is a massive salmon in that pool. He's gone for that fly twice. He wasn't smiling anymore. The fly was cast and recast right back into the hole. How many times has that happened when I've been fishing, I wonder? How close have I been to my own Leviathan and not even realised it was there? Surely that fish is going to go for it this time, though. I watch on, holding my breath, and Dad gets that great fish to rise up again. Many months later, I read the following words by Michael Wigan. A salmon that has dwelt in one place for over a month may have watched innumerable flies swinging over it and pays them no greater attention than the man on the park bench does who subconsciously watches buses looping their circuit. I wish I'd known that then. The fish, like a jealous boyfriend removing his girlfriend from a club, nosed right up to Dad's fly and chaperoned it from the pool. We tried every fly in the box after that, but only Dave managed to get that great fish to move again. However, it was not going to make a mistake for any of us. That salmon wasn't interested in anything other than rain and spawn. The story of Dad fishing with the blood clots hadn't actually been news to me. Granddad had told me about that treasured memory before. Of course he had. He broke his bream record twice that day. It was the other fishing memories that spilled from Dad's head. Mundane stories when records weren't on the menu that were much more telling about their relationship. I would have to trudge behind him for miles carrying his gear, recalled Dad. Off to some distant swim where we would sit in the cold for hours. And if I tangled my line, that was it. I was on my own. It would reduce me to tears trying to unknot those bird's nest tangles as he just carried on fishing. Grandad was extraordinarily blinkered when it came to his determination to catch her himself. And even when Dad did manage to cast a line and hook into something, it was hardly a cause for celebration. I remember him putting a huge lobworm on my hook and me then landing this really big perch. You'd think he'd be pleased. He was absolutely green with envy. We both laughed. I could picture it perfectly. It was all beginning to add up. It'd never been about sharing his world with others. It was about catching well and winning. It felt obviously and immediately familiar. It was me. I was strangely relieved. All this time I'd been chasing Grandad's higher wisdom, it had never actually occurred to me that he had been bound by exactly the same failings as me, when he was on the banks as a younger man. but he must have changed at some point later in his life. Grandad may have resembled his younger self at times, but he was undoubtedly a lot more relaxed on the banks we had shared. I wonder when the transformation in him had occurred, and why. When he taught me to fish, he spent far more time paying me close attention than he did actually fishing himself. If I tangled my lines, he would make me untangle them, but he would always help. He would never have fished on. Two stories stuck in my mind as Dad recounted his experiences. The first was an evening when Grandad and Grandma were babysitting us, and Grandad spent the entire night carefully untangling one of my rods for me. The second was the absolute pleasure he took in seeing me catch a big fish. When I was 8 years old, he helped me land a thuggish and powerful tench, scooping it out of the river with handfuls of lily stems, embracing me and cheering with joy. The late great fishing godfather, Bernard Venables, famously noted the three stages of an angler's evolution, summarized by Luke Jennings in the excellent Blood Knots. To begin with, as a child, you just want to catch fish, any fish. Then you move to the stage where you want to catch big fish. And finally, with nothing left to prove, you reach a place where it's the manner of the catch that counts, the rigor and challenge of it. At which point the whole thing takes on an intellectual and perhaps even a philosophical cast. Fishermen reflect their life in their fishing. Grandad just didn't have anything left to prove, to himself, to the world of man, fish or his son, by the time I turned up with my Argus introduction to fishing kit. Grandparents often become second parents, but they get second chances too. I make a very close link between our belonging here and the will to fish, Bernard Venable said towards the latter stages of his own career. Most of the things which are least pleasant about life now are the things which are most anti-ethical to fishing. Fishing, he believed, was sullied by competition, by men taking on other men, by obsessing over size and records, by inviting self-promotion and all the jealousy that came with it. It took my granddad a long time, but as we headed towards our last cast together, he cared for nothing more than company. There was more to Grandad curbing his enthusiasm for competition than simply a mellowing with age, however. If he really had always been obsessed with just catching, then the commercial carp fishery would have represented the absolute zenith of his angling ambitions, and the modernization of the sport, the carbon elasticated poles, the bait runners on reels, the bite alarms and synthetic baits, would have all been must-haves in the decades before his epiphany. Yet, even when he was at his most addicted to the sport, his methods barely changed from when he was a child. Grandad despised the commercial carp fishery as it suppressed the wild and precarious element for which he fished. Fishing rivers was a distillation of his character, unpredictable and bold. He felt changes in fishing eviscerated the sport of his elemental sense of fairness and dulled the angler's wits and skill. On that, he had common ground with his son. Plus, they were both fantastic observers of the natural world. Fairness and a keen eye for nature. For all Grandad's faults, they were two great traits to pass on to his son. Dad had just applied their uses to different ends and standards, but he was still his father's son. Stepping out of your dad's shadow can be hard. Grandad had been a legend in his own lifetime, and my dad, the local doctor, was known by everyone in my area. I occasionally found it hard too. A lot of people really looked up to my dad, and I felt, as the doctor's son, that I was expected to behave in a certain way. People knew who I was, and even though it wasn't ever said, I felt whatever I did would be held up for extra scrutiny as a result of my dad. I wondered whether that influenced me in my determination to plough my own furrow later in life. I knew my expeditions were something that Dad could and would never do. They were dangerous and risky, and they had no obvious outcomes, paychecks or prospects. He made it very clear he didn't approve of me leaving steady jobs to pursue those dreams, and that served to spur me on even more to make a success of what I was trying to do. It was hardly a wholesale rejection of him, though. I massively coveted my dad's attention and approval, more than anything else, in fact, and when he showed any interest in what I was doing, I gratefully embraced him within my world. It's a curious dichotomy of growing up. The desperate rejection of figureheads while secretly wanting to imitate them at almost every stage of our lives. For most of us, a predictable pattern inevitably follows that sees us steadily morphing into a version of the very role models we spend so much of our energy and time denigrating. In that, I was no exception. More and more I see my own father in me, not just a zero-tolerance attitude for lateness at airports, but an appreciation of life's details, an interest in how the world ticks, for both good and bad. I don't feel like I'm in such an enormous rush anymore, that it's me versus the world, or that I'm constantly having to prove myself to other people. But I haven't quite abandoned Venable's second stage of the angler's evolution either. So I still occasionally seek big fish and big challenges. But at least I know enough now to try to live and fish for the things that make me and the people closest to me happiest. I've always loved my dad, and only hope I might be half the man he is one day. I was alone in the gorge as my fly descended neatly into the mouth of a salmon. It rose up from behind a rock and sucked it right in. It was so close I could see the sun reflecting off the white on the roof of its mouth. Indeed, I was so close, I was also able to perfectly track the frame of the fly leaving the fish's mouth and disappearing around the bend. The old suck and blow, it had done me in. It was as close as I got to snaring my first salmon on the fly, but I wasn't too disheartened. As Dad, Nigel and I made to leave, Dave stayed on with his new recruit, another superb salmon fisherman named John. "We used to fish all the time with a friend who once went 13 years without a salmon," John began. "He'd come with us, and we'd always let him take the first cast in the top pools, or the water that was easier to fish, but he just caught nothing. It must have been so disheartening, especially when we would catch from the pool he had just left. Then one day on the D, he caught two grilse to start, then a spring of salmon. It was like a curse was lifted. He didn't stop catching after that. I just needed some more time. Nothing was caught for the rest of the week, but I emerged from my time on the Fintorn deeply satisfied in a way I hadn't been for years. If I hadn't already been surprised to learn that it doesn't matter if you don't catch anything big, I was quite shocked to realise that it actually doesn't matter if sometimes you don't catch anything at all. "Grandad, I've got someone I'd like you to meet." I'd seen Grandad almost every day when I lived with my sister and James back in the Fens. But since I'd moved back to Cardiff to work on the BBC series, my visits to his home had become inevitably more infrequent. His dementia had been steadily worsening over the last year, but in the last few months it had become really quite severe. He was living in a residential care home away from Grandma and spent the greater part of his days asleep in a chair, not really aware of where or who he was most of the time, and barely speaking at all. I squeezed his hand and repeated my words. I'd warned Emma about his state, but I'd wanted him to meet her anyway, even if it was only to be a token gesture. She took his hand tenderly, and quite suddenly some light penetrated the dark clouds that had previously been puddling his mind. He woke up, and in that moment seemed to return to the saddle of his motorbike, screaming into the nurse's quarters with his shock of black hair and that devil-may-care attitude. "Grandad, this is Emma." He took her in through his big brown eyes and flashed her a handsome grin. "Hello, Ken," Emma blushed. "Is Will a good fisherman?" "He thinks he is," he replied, "the cheeky bugger." I held his other hand. They were the last words we would share together. 3 years after I caught that first taff salmon, Emma and I returned to the very spot where the fish was caught. It was cold and the river taff was in a foul mood. I had a couple of casts, but sometimes there is no serendipity to fishing. I knew I didn't need that fish anymore. Perhaps the river knew it too. That weekend, we were married. Coming home. For all of our time together in the Fens, the thick-lipped and fat-chested chub was very much Grandad's fish. He talked about catching them from the running water around Bedfordshire with relish. "Large lumps of bread crust or a plump slug, that's all you need for a whacking great chub, my boy." I caught my first one on a metal spinner and wisely elected not to tell him anything about it, My second came 20 years later and told me with certainty that he was finally on his way out. Dad took him out fishing just one more time. It was to a local pond in the centre of a town park, and despite a cancer beneath his right eye and floating blobs that cruelly obscured his vision, he still managed to winkle out a tiny perch or two. The tiny perch, the fisherman's escort in and out of the sport. On the front cover of the order of service at his funeral was a picture of him holding the monster perch, caught from our favourite swim at Popham's O. I felt my chest heave and eyes fill with tears as I looked at it. He had been on his way for a long time, so there was no sense of robbery at his loss, but time did little to dull the impact of actually losing him for good. The gathering of friends and family brought out many of the old stories. Some were familiar, such as the time his friend was so thoroughly depressed at being outfished by him, they swapped rods, only for Grandad to continue to catch more. Other stories were new even to me, including one outrageous tale involving Grandad's knowledge of the Russian word for ice cream and an interrogation at the hands of the KGB. I made a small speech about what he meant to us grandchildren, but I struggled to talk about his relationship with his son. It felt uncomfortable, as if all the awkwardness of his alpha male posturing and the resultant shunning of real emotions had been transferred directly onto me for the day. Grandad was very different to Dad, but he was nonetheless extraordinarily proud of his son and loved him deeply. He just couldn't bring himself to publicly show it. If I had my time again, I would say what he once told me on the riverbank. The banks always were his confessional box. "Just aim to be like your dad, Will," he said. "Aim to be like your dad." I wanted to end this journey back where it began. I wanted to come home. I wanted to see the creek again and fish Popham's O. I needed to see the fens. I hadn't been back since his funeral over 2 years ago, and I hadn't fished Popham's O since I carried Grandad off the banks on our last fishing trip together. Almost every fish I've tried to catch from when this challenge began has been influenced by what he tried to teach me there. I need to go back now to really see what else I have learnt. Going full circle, right back to where, in effect, it all began, is the only way I will know if I've really changed at all. It was the week before Christmas when I began the long drive cross-country from South Wales to Fenland. I'd returned from a honeymoon in Zambia and headed straight back out to New Guinea for more filming with BBC Two, so I really wasn't ready for the cold on my return, and nor was the van. Strong crosswinds and exposure made it a bit like steering a sail between the great concrete pillars that hold up the M4 bridge into Wales, fittingly rising up like giant rugby posts in this rugby-mad nation. I love crossing the River Severn in bad weather, though, just so I can see the bleak savagery of the wind-whipped tidal currents, the coal-black exposed rock at low tide. The fish are probably impossible to catch in conditions like this. I gaze into the turbid waters and imagine the advancing squadrons of bass as the tide changes, the flatfish and the elver eels on their way up on the ride. I've rarely seen it worse than this down there, but the fish are just fine. Humans, though, would stand no chance. Stripped down and bare without technology or clothing, the far bank would hang tantalizingly in view, but your body would slide away on the savage current long before you froze to death. I sail over the bridge and on into England. There is a great value to keeping an eye out for wildlife, even on motorways as barren in feel as the M4. There are always red kites to be spotted, cutting through the sky and seeking roadkill, and a great many deer species hang on the fringes of the woodland, set aside at the road's edge, staring forward with their twitching ears and glassy, doll-like eyes. Everything drops away as the sun fades. 3 hours in, and the earth is flattening around me, an indication I'm entering the far east of the country. By the time I finally reach the outskirts of the fens, it is already pitch black. Fen black. It should be its own colour. The density of the darkness on the long roads between communities here is something you can only fully experience on a clear winter's night like this. It feels like I've been ejected into deep space, ploughing my van on through some infinite void. Wispy, Frozen mist envelops me as I head out onto the fields. But I am calm. I learned to drive in these conditions, and am far more fearful of driving in big cities than I ever will be driving out here. A buzzard rests near the royal purple sign that welcomes me back into Fenland proper. I catch its feathers in the headlight beam of my car. Its wings are angled down and flattened by the moisture in the air. It looks like the large, leathery hood of an axe-wielding executioner from the Middle Ages when it hangs in the trees like that. The bird is waiting until first light to hunt. We both are. This darkness, especially nightfall, had a big role to play during my childhood. It was the time all activity, fishing and war games, must come to an end. No matter how far from home we were, we all knew the consequences of arriving back through the front door in the Fen Black. My life was one without mobile phones, or even clocks. We ate when we were hungry, and used the passage of the sun across the sky to dictate what we would do next. Everything else could be pushed to the limits, but there was no justification for a post-dusk homecoming. Besides, we respected our parents and valued our liberty far too much to ever push our luck too far. It was only when I left this area and met people from outside that I began to realise how different my childhood had been to most. As long as we were home before dark and didn't speak to strangers, my friends and I pretty much did as we pleased. We looked after each other and stuck together. As long as we kept to the basic rules, we had the chance to be free. Really free. Although the draining of the fens began in 1630, it would take right through till the 1850s for the fertile farmland to be effectively free of water. The introduction of Victorian engineering and the first steam-powered pumps saw the land increase in value some four times over. The fens would become the vegetable basket of Britain, and people flocked to help with the massive harvests on the exposed blackened peat. Soon, the sense of familiarity is so intense I feel I can almost close my eyes and drive the rest of the way home. Ringsend, Guyhern, Wisbeach St. Mary, Leverington, Wisbeach, and the spectral glow of the old factory site I used to work on. All so well known, yet so distant, as if they were locations cast off from another life I had once led. The A47 leads me on down to the roundabout by the Elm Hall Hotel. This is the place where I turned towards my village, but I always knew it for the little roadside fishing pond, stocked for the workers in the local canning factory. My friends fished it once and spoke of catching dozens of little common carp on sweet corn. I was much older when I eventually made it there to fish, but it was already long barren of its anglers and carp. At one end, the wind was corralling hundreds of super-strength cans of Polish beer on the water's surface. When change came here, it came quickly. The modern-day mechanisation of farming practices after the Second World War both dramatically reduced the number of labourers needed and boosted the land's productivity to stratospheric proportions. By the late 1980s, the fens were accounting for more than one-third of the national output of vegetables, and the supermarket's use of new computer technology meant orders could be placed the moment a product had been purchased. With the scan of a barcode and click of a mouse, the supply chain was essentially streamlined and retrofitted around the exact buying habits of the consumer. Massive orders of fruit and vegetables were now capable of doubling or halving overnight. So farms and their factories took to calling in their workers to pick, pack and process at the shortest notice possible. But supermarket competition and customer expectation demanded the product price was still kept as low as possible. There was no real rise in wages for the legions of workers who had survived when the machines replaced people. But the uncertain shifts, unpredictable hours, and now the crap wages on top meant many locals finally felt that enough was enough. There were still many jobs that needed the human hand, though. The farmers and factory owners were going to have to look elsewhere. I was sheltered from these monumental changes as a child, particularly as I was still able to find local work fruit picking as a teenager well into the 1990s. But in the time it took me to leave school and finish my degree, I went from being able to walk onto a factory line anywhere to finding it virtually impossible to get a job at all. Many of my friends in the fields and factories blamed the migrant workers for coming over here and taking all the work. But this was as far from the mark as those that pointed fingers at the lazy benefit-scrounging local population who were all just racist. When the locals had started to refuse to meet the new demands, farms and factories simply turned to foreign gangmasters and agencies to pick up the shortfall. Eastern European workers from the poorest parts of the former Soviet bloc, Poland at first, but latterly Latvians, Lithuanians and Russians, flooded to the area on the false promise of good wages and regular jobs. But when they arrived, they discovered that the meagre wages they were to be paid were largely siphoned into the hands of criminal gangmasters, under the guise of being back payments on transportation costs, or taken as outlandish rental rates from the overcrowded houses they were placed in. Away from the houses, I began to notice tents cropping up, concealed deep within hedges and patches of trees. Out on the banks, fike nets and long lines turned up for the first time in my lifetime. People were desperate. Desperate enough to spend winter in a tent. Desperate enough to risk a criminal record for poaching fish, accruing debts with terrible people, and sinking into a worse state of poverty than the one they had left behind. The rate of new migrants coming into the area was higher than anywhere else in the UK. It had to be. No one else would tolerate that sort of treatment longer than they had to. Soon, some of the worst examples of poverty in the country were to be seen right on my doorstep. But that should hardly be surprising, should it? When we demand our food is available at bargain prices, around the clock and throughout the seasons, there was always going to be someone paying the cost somewhere. There were times I felt like we were all cast adrift in flooded fens. I grew up in a Bermuda Triangle of land where the county borders of Lincolnshire, Norfolk and Cambridgeshire all meet. We had one train line a half an hour's drive away, a scattering of main roads and definitely no motorways, and our nearest McDonald's took two bus journeys and a change at Wisbeach. In the Norfolk Broads or on the North Norfolk coast, it is all part of the charm, but visitors rarely came to my neighbourhood through choice. And yet, I still love it here. There is a sense of the truly mystical to the big skies and open fields, and the greatest sunsets and starry nights I will ever see have always been here. A comic once said if you stand on a milk crate, you can see the curvature of the earth. As a child, I would sneak out the back of the house in the depths of winter and climb the last apple tree in the orchard. From my vantage point, I could see across the earthen sugar beet fields, stripped bare of their crop and frozen solid like the sea. I used to imagine it was the point where the world was stitched together, an elongated patch atop the earth's surface, sewn in the same way my school trousers were when I hold the kneecap. Fenland people are mocked, of course. We are the uneducated, slack-jawed inbreds. NFN, normal for Norfolk, the outsiders like to joke. Folk of the flat interned in a land where people go mad because of the lack of hills. Later, the madness was actually attributed to malaria from the swamps, but we never shed the rest of the character stains. And everywhere I go, people like to poke fun about where I'm from. It doesn't bother me, though. I like the people I grew up with here. And I actually felt sorry for people that took the piss out of us, as I knew they had missed out. Most of all, I like the adult contentment of feeling small in a vast, unbroken landscape. I am grateful to this land, for the respect and interest in water it has given me, the lack of fear and sense of control I have in the wild. I now realise that it is something special, and not something simply innate in everyone. Perhaps I'm indulging my nostalgia now I no longer live here. I couldn't wait to leave this place when I did. I felt a sense of suffocation as I grew older, that the whole place was getting perversely smaller and more inward-looking with each year of my life that passed. New Year's Eve and when Glastonbury was on as a teenager were always the worst. Watching mass celebrations on the television, I would feel frustrated and jealous of everyone else. Worse still, I couldn't shake the feeling that we were the sorts of people that would never be invited to the party. However, a decade after all of my friends and I had been released from the fens and headed to jobs in the big cities of Britain, I realised that it was now that we were actually trapped for real, and what we had as kids would never be ours again. I never really felt at home in cities, and thought that any day soon someone in a suit would tap me on the shoulder and remind me where I was from, that I was wearing the Emperor's new clothes, that it was time to go home now, and that my performance was over. It took another 10 years before I realised everyone else working in the city feels exactly the same. According to the Wilson Encyclopedia, the roach is the most commonly caught British freshwater shoal fish. It was the foot soldier of the creek, the fish that made up the bulk of my keep net as a child. But as a result of their sheer volume and small size, I feel they never really received the respect they deserve. Coming home, it had to be the roach I went for. The eyes are a virulent, violent red in colour. But there is something of the underdog spirit in the way the rest of its curved and downward-facing mouth appears. Its neat head fronts a classically fish-shaped body, and with white silver sides and orange-red fins, it is, unfortunately, the prime target for live baiting for pike. A Finnish friend of mine even uses their eyeballs to catch perch. "But they shimmer with an animation you just can't get from any bait," he said, in response to my disgust at his practice. As I said, the roach deserves more respect. Before the opening day of the course season on the 16th of June, I would walk the creek and look under the bridges at Popham's Oe. Thousands of roach in great shoals were to be seen basking in the sunshine together, and the day couldn't come quick enough when we could try and catch them. The greatest catch I ever made came in that opening week. I was on the River Delph at Welney with Grandad, Dad and my friend Lee. We had happened upon a truly bar shoal of roach that would not stop biting. We baited with maggots and threw in breadcrumbs by the handful till we had precipitated a feeding frenzy so great that even when we ran out of free feed, they still just kept on coming. They continued to bite through pike attacks. They even continued to bite when I fell in. It was simply an incredible day's fishing. And when it came to tip our keep nets up and return the roach to the river, I can still remember that feeling of amazement that such a great quantity of fish could be living in such a small patch of river. Numbers, though, are one thing. There were other days when the roach came on strong for a time, but out of the thousands and thousands that came to my hook, the biggest I ever landed was well under the 2 pound mark. Jack Hargreaves writes, "It took me 30 years to catch a 2 pound roach, even fishing in the best southern roach waters. The current record roach, standing at 4 pounds 4 ounces, was caught from a lake in Northern Ireland, and the only river to feature any fish in the current top 10 record roach list is the Stour in Dorset." Truly, the fens were never likely to trouble the roach record books then. But some very fine roach have been landed here, many fish over 2 pounds. And I even once heard of a fish in excess of 3 pounds coming from the Great Ouse near Ely. In angling, there is always a chance. But really, how much did I actually care by this stage? I approached the outskirts of my village a little before dawn. My entire childhood world had just been compressed into a little under an hour in the car. But 15 years after I'd left, it was heartening to discover my village had hardly changed. I chose to drive the long way to Popham's Oe, so I could pass both houses we had lived in. The first, a beautiful Georgian doctor's house in the middle of the village, had electronic Christmas candles in the window. The second, on the outskirts, had a new shed on one side, and that seemed to be the sum of the modifications. I drove beside the creek, noting the nonsensical new sign that declared it the Nene Ouse Navigation Link, then on past the butchers, the hairdressers, the corner shop, and Navradi's, which still sells the best fish and chips in Britain. Out towards the end of the village, I closed in on Grandad's place, but flicked the indicator to signal right, just before I made it to his bungalow. Following the nail-straight road towards the 16-foot bank, I headed instead towards his spiritual home, travelling just a few hundred metres before pulling into a small lay-by beside a field. You wouldn't know the river was here in light or dark. The pancake flat landscape creates an optical illusion that hides Popham's Oe perfectly in its dip. But I knew it was there. I opened the boot and lifted out a large bucket filled with ground bait and a couple of tubs of maggots and casters. It was cold, but not as cold as it used to be at this time of year. When I was a child, the winters here could be savage. Days of sub-zero temperatures would freeze the field solid and turn the flooded Welney washes into a giant ice rink that produced many a champion speed skater. But the walk along the edge of the field towards our spot was still just as long as I remember. The fen drains intimidate some anglers. They appear as a blank canvas, miles of unrelenting uniformity in both directions, with very few obvious fish-holding features to cast at. When Grandad came here, he'd walk from his bungalow, across the road, and alongside a small orchard between the field and the river. He followed a fence line to a concrete post at its end. Here, he would tie off a length of rope for safety, and, effectively, abseil his way down the bank to the water's edge. That was where I needed to be, and I did eventually find the post, still standing proud. But it would take till the sun was fully up for me to realise the fence and the entire orchard were all long gone. One solitary old apple tree remained, surrounded by long grass. I gripped the cold concrete post and feel an overwhelming sense of belonging. I used to sit right here when I was old enough to come to the O on my own. I'd wait for him, his heavy steps along the bank, his, "All right, my beaut," greeting. It would never come again now, but I can still feel his presence here, far more than I could at his funeral service, or by holding his rods, or reading his books. This is where we both once belonged. Wet mist soaks the banks. I'd been nervous walking here, warning myself repeatedly to take my time and watch my step, that one slip in the darkness could see me plummet from height and into the drain. But the post makes me feel secure, and the banks are nothing like as steep as I found them as a child. I move down easily and quickly towards the water's side. I doubt many people have been here since I last fished this spot with Grandad all those years ago. The bed of common reeds on this bank stands some 8 foot high, forming a caramel yellow fence between me and the water. But there is still a gap just big enough for me to squeeze into my seat and cast my roach tackle. I begin rolling apple-sized balls of ground bait laced with maggots and casters. The sluice gates are open downstream at Denver, so the water is pushing through at a real clip. Plus, there is 12 foot of deep water in front of me. If I want to guarantee the balls make it to the bottom of the river, I will have to squeeze them really tight. This is where I want the roach shoals to find them. And then, once the shoals are here and feeding confidently, I'll flick out a hook. I must remember to keep the bait going in, though. It won't last long in this flow, and I want to hold the fish here for as long as I possibly can. It's not little and often, it's a lot and often, Will. That's what Grandad would have said had he been next to me now. Then he would have told his old story about the fishing match he once lost because he only brought 10 kilos of ground bait with him. Don't be afraid to keep it going in, as once the roach are gone, you'll never get them back. I throw the bait in as accurately as I can and return to the car for the rods. 2 hours slide by, and the sun gently rises without bringing much warmth. The river elects to retain its misty coat, and small jenny wrens buzz around in the reeds like hummingbirds. On the far bank, a pair of swans dance neck to neck out across the water, but mostly it is very quiet. I didn't realise how much I missed the silence. The real fenlands personify a rare brand of solitude. Many can't hack it. I can understand that, and I've always felt for the occupants of the remote farmhouses out here. Miles from people and each other. Clumps of rotting water lily leaves float past on the flow. The living plant that formed them is firmly on the retreat now, back towards the silty riverbed, where it will safely wait until the weather warms once more. In the spring, the lily beds are dense and sometimes many meters thick. I used to love fishing off these lilies. It produced some of our finest fish, but a monster lived in there too, a fish that contained unstoppable power. It was our Moby Dick. I hooked it just once. Grandad managed it several times, of course, but neither of us ever saw that beast. It simply tore the line from our reels and straightened our hooks right out. Looking back, we never once scaled our gear up to actually attempt to land the creature. We simply tolerated its occasional intrusion. Probably in much the same way as it tolerated us. Many years later, a young lad from the neighbouring village of Three Holes landed a carp well in excess of 20 pounds from this very stretch of water. Perhaps that was all the legend had ever amounted to. but we never like to think so. I've set up for the roach exactly as Grandad taught me, with one of his handsome handmade floats, thick and well weighted, set at 12 feet in depth, with the bulk of my shot strung out close to a small hook. I want to get the bait right down in the river, but if I don't get a bite down on the river bed, that doesn't mean the roach are definitely not present. I'll just have to adjust the float and bring my bait off the bottom a little, an inch or two every 10 minutes or so, just to check that they aren't shoaling a little higher up and intercepting all my ground bait as it sinks through the water column. Even with the heavy float and weight, I still have to steady the tackle in the flow, mending the line, almost as if I were float fishing the river taff. I keep the bait trickling in with one hand and fix my eye firmly on the bright red tip of the float for any possible indication of arriving roach. Roach can be extraordinarily cute when they take the bait, and sometimes a gentle bite might only register as a tickle on the float tip. In his prime, Grandad could seemingly catch roach without any indication whatsoever, though. He would give a sudden crack of his wrist, and there the roach would be, writhing on his hook as if spirited there by some unseen force. When the poet Ted Hughes wrote of float fishing in 1967, he commented that your whole being rests lightly on the float. That's the state you must look to achieve to be a truly successful float fisher like Grandad. A condition of such intense concentration that there is nothing more in life than you and your float, when a pulse, a flick, a tremble on that tip will register in your body as if an earthquake has struck under your tackle box. It sounds tense, it really isn't, and even if you fall short of such a lofty goal, float fishing still offers its junior practitioners a shot at pure escapism. Staring at a float erodes stress at a far greater rate than any trip to the gym, pub, or psychiatrist's couch ever will. It alleviates anxiety and leaves the angler fixed within a world where there are no bills to pay, no pieces of work to deliver, and no problems at home. Time both slows down and speeds up. You can spot micro details, like how a cloud of nymphs expands and contracts on a river's surface, or how a kingfisher dramatically throws its neck forward as it strikes the water. But while observing the translucence on the wing of some damsel, or watching a toad crawl in animated slow motion, you suddenly realize it is getting dark and that you didn't even touch your lunchtime sandwiches. I always feel better after a day's float fishing, even when I miss all my bites. And if I were allowed to fish only one method for the rest of my life, then the float would be it. I tried to settle into the rhythm of my float that morning, but it was impossible to get over the piece of my personal history I was sat in. Why did Grandad fish here almost exclusively for the last 20 years of his life? I'd always put it down to the O's close proximity to his bungalow, but he really could have lived just about anywhere in the village. I blew some hot air and life back into my fingers. Popham's O didn't have the obvious aesthetics of the creek even. You had to look hard for both the beauty and the fish down here. Maybe that was part of it. The idea that it was a bigger challenge. The fish here were definitely bigger if you did find them, but I knew there was more at play here too. I flicked a lily pad off the float. I never want to return to fishing just one set of venues for just one fish. But the immense enjoyment to be had at seeing a river change its shape and character from just one vantage point seemed pretty clear. Only by returning to the same place over and over again can you see that no one day is ever the same as the next. Watching a river change its character through the season somehow ballasts us as anglers and people. It reminds us of our own mortality in the face of natural forces that are out of our control. It should not be an intimidating or frightening prospect. There is great comfort to be found in the discovery of something larger than your life. I can very well imagine that bearing witness to the changes in your grandchildren has a similar effect. Eventually, we all get left behind, of course. But at least we can take steps to make sure that when we do go, the things we love continue to grow without us around. Grandad kept his grandchildren and this place close. I knew he was proud of us all. And now, against all the odds, I found my way right back here to check all is well on his behalf. I bet he always knew I would as well. the silly old sod. Zhang Taigong was a statesman and strategist who lived in ancient China in the second millennium before Christ. According to legend, he had served the tyrannical Zhu